Last time we've covered type checking. Now, in the last three lectures, we'll be looking at something completely different, namely the synthesis part of the compiler where we generate code. So in order to be able to generate code, we need to know, well, what we are generating code for. So there's different processes, and they have different instruction sets. And what I'll first talk about is possible targets for code generation. And in particular, I'm not going to say how to generate code for an ARM or for an x86, because that is quite involved, and that is not necessarily leading to more insight than just the normal, like a simpler machine. And what we'll do is, like, we try to define a very simple machine and then can generate code for this very simple machine. Okay, so first of all, what is the principle of code generation? Well, we have our abstract syntax tree. We've annotated it with at least we've resolved the symbols, so every usage of an identifier kind of is connected to the definition side. And then we have done some type checking, which means that we can always assume that we can generate sensible code, so we're not adding a float to a pointer, because the type checker will have caught that, and if the programmer has added some casts, for instance, then that means the AST has explicit conversion code, like as a node that has explicit conversion to, say, a float to a pointer, if that makes sense. So what we need to do is we need to be able to traverse the AST, and then we have to create code for each kind of non-terminal of the grammar, similar to like just computing an attribute. The code is just another attribute of the abstract syntax tree. So at the end, so this is like the topic is called synthesizing code, and then you can imagine that code synthesis is basically a synthetic attribute. We start with the leaves, and we build up more and more complex programs, and then eventually at the leaf of each function. At the root, say where a function declaration is, we have the code for the whole function then. And then we can just like spit it out and write it to file, for instance, and then run an assembler and then run it on the machine. And so what we need for code generation is we need the declarations, and because the declarations tell us how much memory we have to allocate, and the type information might be necessary in order to say how we generate code. So, for instance, if we just know that we are writing, like if we have a C statement that says star x equals to 7, we need to know that, well, x is an int pointer, for instance. Otherwise, we don't know how many bytes we have to write here. Okay. So what do we need to know in order to generate code? There's two things. We need to know what the semantics of the constructs are in our syntax tree. So we need to know what the input language is supposed to do. And we're assuming we use some sort of C standard, like C99, because it's a simple language, not because it's a very good language. Or very intuitive language. It has some pitfalls and some interesting concepts that makes code generation then in turn maybe a little bit more interesting. And other languages like Haskell in particular or ML have a slightly different way of, different semantics, different computational model, and generating machine code for those languages is a little bit more tricky, especially Haskell, which is lazily evaluated. So you don't evaluate something until you have to, and that kind of requires a big graph at runtime, and we don't want to deal with that in this lecture. Okay, and the second thing we need to know is the semantics of the machine instructions. So we need to know what the machine does, which instruction it supplies, and what the semantics of these instructions are. And I will be focusing on this in the first half of the lecture. In particular, I'm going to like discuss a little bit what various machines there are and the models they impose. So we're going to define the semantics of certain machine instructions, and for that we need to look at certain machines. And throughout the lecture, I will use a so-called register C machine, which is an abstract machine. So the register C machine is abbreviated with RCMA, and it's a virtual machine, which means there's no actual processor that can execute these instructions, which doesn't really matter because we can always build an interpreter. And whereas in like 10 years ago, you would really have to explain that this is a good idea, but now that we have the Java virtual machine and the Microsoft runtime machine and many other, like Python has also a virtual machine. So there's many, many languages out there that actually already use some sort of virtual execution environment. And this has not been proven to be such a bad idea, and it's not as inefficient as people would have thought like 20 years ago, because there's many things one can do if we have just an interpreter. So we do have some sort of more or less working prototype of a visualizer, which means it's kind of a debugger. You can step through your program, and then it will basically show what the register contents are and what the stack contains, and that can basically is our interpreter. And it's not there for speed, it's not there to add to actual computation, but it's there to check whether the code you've generated is actually runnable or whether you've made a mistake somewhere. So the R schema, for simplicity, doesn't actually have all the C types that C has. So it doesn't have floating point types. It doesn't have the non-int, the integers. So it doesn't have int bytes or double or words or quad words. It only has normal integers, and these integers, because it's written in Java, it's just like the Java integers, really. And there's also no instructions to actually communicate with the outside world, so no instructions to print. I think there might be an instruction to print just to simplify that. But there's not many instructions to do that. And normally we'd have to have an interface with the operating system to do that. Okay, and one speciality of this register C machine that is that it has an infinite supply of registers. And so every normal virtual machine, every normal processor has a fixed set of registers, and these are very fast. And for instance, the Java virtual machine doesn't have any registers. It just uses a stack, as we will see. And so we're just using this machine with this infinite set of registers because it's a very good model to do code generation for, because that is what a normal compiler does. And later there's a phase where you limit the number of registers to a finite set of registers that are actually there. But for now, and throughout the rest, we'll just assume that we have an infinite supply of registers. Okay, as I say, this R schema is actually not so unrealistic. It's so the restriction with requiring an unlimited set of registers can be lifted easily. That's not a big problem. The Java virtual machine is actually very similar to the R schema, except it doesn't have any registers. And we could also like write something like the Java virtual machine for our CMO programs. Okay, now, so in order to understand how this R CMO works, I will first look a little bit at how a virtual machine like the Java virtual machine works. So in general, they both have in common that both any virtual machine has some sort of instructions, and that these instructions are not executed on actual hardware, but on virtual hardware. And this virtual hardware is basically a piece of software that implements whatever this hardware model is. So it's basically only a collection of data structures that is modified by the different instructions. So in order to interact with the outside environment, you might have a so-called a runtime system that provides an interface to the operating system and that does something like organizing the heap with a garbage collector, for instance. and one part of this runtime system is the interpreter itself. So you have a code and you have the runtime system, and together they form an executable program. Okay, so I'm briefly we'll talk about the Java virtual machine, just because it is a very simple machine, and it will help to illustrate the concepts that we need for the RCMA. Okay, so the Java virtual machine has a code segment, which is called C, which contains the bytecode, and it has an instruction counter called the PC, the program counter, and it has a stack, and it has a stack pointer. So the S, the stack, is the data storage that we use to do local computations, and I'll say in a second what that is. So it is a memory region, and the cells in the memory region are organized in the LIFO, last in first out order, so it's a stack. That's where the S comes from. And the stack pointer is then the top of the stack, and as a convention, it's the last cell that is being used. And beyond S, so any element greater than S, is not used, and in a very simple runtime, you could use this area here for the heap. So, for instance, if you had really old computers in the DOS times where you had 640K of memory and no page table and whatever, you would start, load, you first have your code segment, then you would have your stack, which would grow downwards, and between the code segment and the stack segment, you would allocate dynamic memory. And if so kind of the dynamic memory allocation grows this direction and the stack grows this direction, and when the two memory regions reach, your program is stopped with an out-of-memory error. Well, but nowadays you have paging, so if you run out of free pages, you still get the same problem, but the address space, so you still have one address space per process, and if you run out of addresses, then you have the same problem. But you will first run out of memory before you run out of addresses, unless you have a 32-bit program and 8 gigabytes of memory, then you run out of addresses first. Yes. Okay, so the code memory. For us, and even for, I think even for the JVM, each cell in this code segment holds exactly one virtual instruction, and the code segment can only be read. That is strictly not quite true in the Java world, but that is always some special effect when you load new files, new code into the memory. You have the PC counter that contains the address of the instruction that is supposed to be executed next. And initially, you have to make some assumptions, so throughout we'll just say, well, when the machine starts, the PC will start at zero. Okay, so the basic idea of writing an interpreter for a virtual machine is to write a program that loads the machine instruction from the code point, from the code array or from the code segment at the current program counter, and we store that instruction into some register IR, and then we increment the PC, and then we execute it. So we read the instruction, we increment the program counter, and then we execute the instructions, which will do something, and we do that as long as we forever, really. And if there is an instruction that is called halt or something like that, then maybe that sets something that makes this condition false, or just exits the program in some other way. Okay, just as a note, like the PC, the program counter is incremented before the instruction is executed, because if the instruction modifies the PC, say if it's a jump instruction, then we shouldn't change the PC value after the instruction has been executed. So we first increment the instruction, and if it's a jump instruction that jumps to somewhere else in the program, it will set the PC to some other value, and since we're not touching the PC after we execute the instruction, we will read the jumped to instruction in the next iteration here. Okay, so there will be some sort of halt instruction that directly exits the whole program, the whole interpreter. Otherwise, this will not go on forever. Okay, so let's look at the Java virtual machine for a moment, just to see how the how it works in general. Who of you have been listening to virtual machines? One, two. Okay, then I'll bore you to death, but it'll only last a few minutes. So assume that you want to evaluate this expression 1 plus 7 times 3, and we want to generate instruction sequence for that. So expressions can be arbitrarily long and arbitrarily deeply nested, so we need to have some sort of strategy how to evaluate this. And the idea is to compute the value of an expression and to store its result on top of the stack, and that also holds for any sub-expression. So we first compute the value of a sub-expression, we store its intermediate result on top of the stack, and then afterwards we apply the operation that we want to perform to two expressions. So for instance, in this example here, we first compute this sub-expression, then this sub-expression, they'll both be on the stack, and then we compute the multiplication by taking two elements from the stack and putting the result back onto the stack. Okay, so the primitive operations for this they're composed of loading a constant and of loading variables. So in general, if we then have an operation, we first have to evaluate the arguments and we have to put them on top of the stack, and we do that by evaluating them, because every time we evaluate in a sub-expression AI, we'll have the result on the stack. And then afterwards, we have some sort of operation that consumes these arguments, so like multiplication in the result in the last example. And the result will be put again on top of the stack. Okay, so what are the primitives for that? So first of all, we need to be able to load a constant onto the stack. So the JVM has an instruction called iConstant, which has an argument which is an integer, and it will put this integer constant on top of the stack. So the semantics is that we'll increment the stack, and the position, the top of the stack will be assigned to Q, and Q is some sort of integer. Okay, and then once we have the value of two sub-expressions on the stack, so for instance, we might have evaluated something that relates to 8 and something that evaluates to 3, then we can have the standard binary operation. So for instance, here it's imul, which is an instruction that multiplies the two arguments. So what it does, it decrements the stack by one element, and it uses the stack element that is here and here, so the top two, so that is, this is the 3 and this is the 8. In this example, it multiplies them and puts the result on top of the stack. So after issuing imul, the stack will have decreased by one element. Yeah, okay, well that's basically what I said. And there's other instructions like iadd, isub, idivide, imod that work very much the same way. There's an alternative behavior for division, for instance. If you divide by 0, you get an exception, and then all sorts of other things happen, but we're not concerned with that here. So we just assume that division works. So in the example, the one sub-expression was 1 plus 7, so if we want to evaluate that, we would issue the instructions 1, which is the left-hand side sub-expression of plus. Then we evaluate icon 7, which is the right-hand side sub-expression, and then we issue iadd, which takes these two expressions, the values from the stack, so the 1 and the 7, adds them and puts the result back onto the top of the stack. Okay, and then there's also variables, so we could have an expression that contains variables. Now, in a variable will that is local to a function only has a limited lifetime. We've discussed that with the shadowing and the lifetime of a variable. So the lifetime begins, lifetimes of a variable x begins when you enter the basic block or the scope where this variable is declared, and the variable ceases to be live when you exit the scope. And so the idea is that when you enter the scope, you reserve some locations on the stack for these variables. So if you have a function f and it has three variables x, y, and z, then some code, then what you would do as soon as you enter the function, you just reserve three slots, one for x, one for y, and one for z, and that's illustrated here. And they're somewhere down in the stack, and you just assume they're there, and you just change the stack pointer accordingly. So these addresses of the variables, so this giving them a unique memory cell, this is done. This can be done when you create the symbol table. So once you've resolved all the variables, you can assign them an address in memory, and this could be just a local address, because if it's a local variable, you might just give them some index. So for the XYZ example, X could be at index 0 relative to the beginning of the stack frame of the function f, and Y could be at 1, and so on. So we store this address at the declaration node, because every usage side is referring to the declaration node, and that's the unique place where we can store this address of the variable. So if we generate code, and we need to generate code that reads the value of x, then we can just look up the address of x in the declaration node. So what we do in the SQL, because I don't want to draw ASTs with declaration nodes, I'm just assuming there is some sort of mathematical map row that maps variables to their address. And here I'm saying relative address because it's for local variables inside the function stack frame, but I'll make clear later what relative really means and how it is different from global variables. So we call this an address environment or simply environment. So for instance, if I want to evaluate the variable x, then Java, for instance, has the iload k instruction, and k here is a relative address and relative to the top of the stack. So if I say iload 2 in this example, I will, and the stack pointer is, if I say iload 1, the stack pointer is pointing to this element in the stack, then the Java virtual machine will go down the stack by one element and read that element and put it on top of the stack. So obviously the address offset changes with the height of the stack. So the semantics of iload k is that the new stack position sp plus 1 is set to the value of the stack at the position sp minus k, because you're going down in the stack. So larger addresses in the stack are, so the stack grows this way, larger addresses are further up, and then we increment the stack point to point one element higher. Okay. So as an example, if we wanted to compute x plus 2, we first evaluate x, and then we evaluate y, 2, and then we evaluate the plus. So since x lives at address 1, we just issue iload 1, then we issue icons 2, which gives us 13 and 2 on top of the stack. Then we have some empty cell over some other cell, and this is the value of x. And then we say I add, and that will add 2 and 13, and we'll put 15 onto the stack. Okay. Are there any questions so far? So this is certainly no surprise for people who have heard virtual machines, but I should repeat this, I think, just to get everybody on the same page. Okay, so now we've seen how to use the stack to evaluate expressions, and The stack is a very neat way to do that because it is virtually no cost to push new elements onto the stack. There's no need to go and fetch some new memory, which has to be managed somehow. It is a very cheap way to get more memory and to shrink it and not have any overhead, any big overhead associated with that. That is the idea of the Java virtual machine. And it works very well because the stack is, in principle, unlimited, or at least within bounds, unlimited. And now I'm going to say how a register machine that has an unlimited set of registers can be implemented in a similar way. So the reason why we want to not generate code for, say, the Java virtual machine is because it represents a machine model that is not reflecting current processes, because current processes have a fixed set of registers, and you need to use these registers so that you can, that the code is efficient. So we have to assume that our machine eventually will have a fixed set, fixed number of universal registers. So universal means you can store anything in that, inside them. There's other processes which are not universal, and even modern architectures like x86 and ARM, they have so-called vector registers, where you have several values and you can modify them all at once with one instruction, so-called vector instructions. But there's other machines like the Motorola 68000. It had a different set of pointer and value registers, and that's also a CISC, so complex instruction architecture processor. So a modern RISC processor usually has quite a few registers, like 16 or even 32, and they can hold either pointers or integers. Floating point is often separate, so I'm just talking about integers and pointers. So the restriction of a RISC processor is then that any arithmetic operation like addition can only be performed on registers and not directly on locations in memory. And that is, therefore, every time we generate code to, for example, execute or compute an addition, we need to load arguments into some sort of registers. So there are special instructions to then load and store values from and to memory, or like to transfer register contents to memory and back. And if we call a function, then the registers that we currently use, they might have to be stored on the stack explicitly, because the function should be able to reuse them. So much more has to be done explicitly, but that also gives us the opportunity to do more optimizations. So a translation for a RISC processor, if we call functions or if we compile functions, we need to store the variables and the function arguments somehow in registers. And before we call a function, we might need to backup the registers onto the stack so that the function can also use the registers without saving them. And eventually, we'd have to express any computation using a finite set of registers. We will not address that problem. I'll just hint at this problem at the very end. For now, it shall suffice that we just look at the first two problems, so to use registers to store variables and function arguments, and we deal with the register, with the allocation, or with the mapping to finitely many registers later. Okay, so what is the principle of the register machine? So it looks similar to the Java virtual machine. So you have a code area, and we have a stack area. We still need a stack because if we call functions, we need to back up registers. And then we have two sets of registers, the so-called local registers, which have indices that are strictly greater than 0, so R1, R2, and RI, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And by convention, I color them in a darkish red. And I have global registers, which are green and which have offsets like indices 0 or negative indices. And I will first talk about the local registers only, so I'm not going to be concerned with the global registers. Okay, so what are the local registers used for? The local registers are used to save temporary results, so when we have arbitrary long expressions, we need to store them somewhere, and that's where we use these local registers with positive integers, positive indices. And if we have local variables, that means variables declared inside a function, we will use local registers. And we'll have some instructions that allow us to efficiently load and store a sequence of registers on the stack, which is useful for function calls. Now, the global registers, in turn, we will use to pass arguments to functions, and we will use them to return the value of a function. And since functions calls will come later, I will not deal with that today. So we'll only use the local registers, and I'll now explain how to use them to store or compute temporary, to perform temporary computations. Okay, so what is the idea for this translation? Now, we have to have some sort of counter, I, that tell us which registers we can still use and which are in use already. So any local register with index j, which is strictly smaller than I, are in use, and we cannot use them because they store values that we might later need. And any register I, which is greater or equal to j, is available. And I'll give an example for that later. So what are the instructions now? So remember, we don't have any instructions that now perform computation like additions and subtractions and so on directly on memory. So all we have are operations, instructions that transfer values from memory to registers and that do computations just on registers. So I'll just look at the computations on registers. So we have an instruction called load C, which loads a constant into a register. So the semantics here is just like C semantics. So the value on the right is assigned to the register on the left. And also move. We have a move instruction that transfers the content of the right register to the left register. And then we have a so-called translation schema, which takes a node in our abstract syntax tree and turns it into a sequence of instructions. And I'm not going to be extremely formal. I'm not saying, oh, instruction is a sequence of instructions is defined like this. I'm just going to write these instructions on the right-hand side as a return value of this function here. So code R, R stands here for right-hand side, or R value. I'll come to that in a second. And I is the index into which I will produce the result. So if I say code R of with index I of a constant C with the address environment row, we'll just create a load C instruction with the constant C and the register RI. So this expression means generate code for the constant C and put the result in the register I. And that is exactly what this instruction does. Just stores the constant C in the register RI. Okay, so if I wanted to generate code for a variable X, then I would call the function code R with index I, X row. And what that will do, it will generate a move instruction from RA, and A is the result of looking up X in this address environment. So if the variable X lives in register A, then I will just create a move instruction that moves the content of register A to register I, because we wanted to have the result generated in I. Okay, and then last, if we have an assignment, X should get the value of E in C in our abstract syntax tree, and we want to have the result in I. So what is the value of an assignment X to E in C? Yeah, so it's the same value as the value that you've assigned. So if you have int x, y, and you say x is equal to y is equal to 7, then y is equal to 7 is an expression that, as a side effect, evaluates 7 to y, and the value of this expression itself is 7, and this value is again assigned to x. So c is a bit funny there, because the assignment is also an expression. That's why you can say if x is equal to 7, then do something, and the value of this conditional is always 7, so it's always true, it's always non-zero. So this is the same thing as saying if true, but it has the side effect of setting x to 7. Okay, so, but for now we can just like look at this as a normal statement, although it's really an expression. So if we want to evaluate the statement, x gets the value of e, then we will first evaluate e into the register I, so that after we've generated this code here, we know that the result is in register RI. And then if x lives at address A, we just move that value from the register I to the register A. Okay, trick question now. Well, this looks a bit inefficient. Is there something better that we can do here? So we could just say generate code for me for the expression E and store the value in register A. And even trickier question, what can go wrong if we do this? Okay, fine. Let's look at the next slide. Okay, so just as a notation thing, if you're really into Linux and open software, then and you look at assembler in Intel, then for some weird reason they have some there's conventions, there's different conventions, and most people use the so-called Intel convention, which is very much like the C way of looking at things. So if you have an operation, a mnemonic, and it has certain operands, like these n plus 1 operands, then the left-hand side operand is the destination, is the register or memory location you're writing to, and then you have operands. So yeah, these are inputs usually, and this is an output. And the GNU assembler uses the so-called AT&T convention, where the destination is on the right-hand side, and the arguments are on the left-hand side. We're not using that, and most processor manuals, they always use the Intel convention, so the result is somehow stored in the very first argument. Okay. So let's look at the binary operators, and then my trick question may become clearer. So if we take any of these ops, these operations, these are all valid mnemonics on our RCMA machine, and they all take three arguments. They take the result, RI, and the two arguments, RJ and RK, and they all have to be registers. They cannot be memory locations. So RI is the so-called target register, and RJ is the first, and RK is the second argument of the instruction. So if we have any operation, so now you have to like read a little bit of syntactic sugar into this. So if this is plus, for instance, you would use the operation add. And if this is minus, you would use the operation sub, and so on. That's why they're a different color. Okay, so if we wanted to generate code for the abstract syntax tree node, E1 op E2, say E1 plus E2, what we do is we first generate code for the left-hand side argument, as before, and we store the result in the ith register. And remember, every register with index I and greater is free, so we can use those. Now, after we executed these instructions, our result will be in register RI. So that is occupied then. So if we want to evaluate the second argument, E2, we need to store the result in register I plus 1 because register I is occupied with the value of E1. So we generate code here, we recursively call the code generation function on E2, and we'll get a result in RI plus 1. And then afterwards, we emit the operation, the op, so add for instance, that takes the value of E1 and the value of E2, which are stored in RI and RI plus 1. It computes the result and it stores the value in RI because here we say we want the result in I, in register I. So this is the code generation schema whenever there is a basic, when you have an expression that has a plus, minus, division, and operation like that. Okay, so for example here, if we wanted to generate the expression 3 times 4 and we're starting with register I, we want to have the result in register I, which is 4, then we say generate code R of 4, given this address environment, which is irrelevant here. Then we generate the code for 3, for 4, because these are the two arguments. And note here that for the first argument, we use I, so 4. And for the second argument, we use I plus 1, which is 5. And which instruction will this create? Load C. So this will create load C 3 R 4 comma 3, well, or no comma, load constant in R 5 and load 4. So and afterwards we have the constant 3 in register R 4, constant 4 in register R 5. The multiplication will take these two values and store the register in R 4, which is where we want it to be. So this is the result. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I pose my trick question again from earlier. If I have the assignment X equals E and I want to generate code for it, code R, I, address environment, I said I want code R, I, E, which generates the code for the expression E in register RI, and afterwards I simply want to do a move R, what was it, 5, because 5 is the target of the register, so the address environment of X says 5, so X is stored at the position 5, and then we just move the value of RI to so this was the code generation schema we had for assignments, and then the question was, well, can I not save this move instruction and have generate the code directly in 5? Yes, and what happens then? Yes, so that something can go wrong because we're using all the registers greater than I potentially. Okay. Yes, that as well. I mean, we don't have a stack. Yeah. We have a mental stack. So there's actually two problems here, and maybe I should just go back to illustrate the very first problem that we haven't touched yet. So here. Suppose I would change this to code 5 R E row. Then one of the problems is that this might not work because it could override registers greater than 5. But actually, if we assume that 5 lives somewhere in the bottom of the stack, this is not going to happen. But what is the problem here? If we have assignments like X equals Y equals 7, and if we translate this expression. So if we first translate this expression using this an abbreviated code schema where we just say A. If the X is lives at location A, we just like store the result in register A instead of I, and omit this move instruction. Oh, come on, this move instruction. Okay, question again. Instead of this code scheme that used to be here, I'm just changing this so that the value of E is generated directly in register A. So this, as you pointed out, if my A, this has two problems. So the one problem is we kind of have some sort of virtual or mental stack of registers that we've used. And we have I, the index I is the first register that we haven't used. And for instance, X could live down here. So in the address environment says that X lives at 5. And so if we generated code that stores the result in 5, as we've seen with the more complex operations, this may override any register with I greater than 5. So this might override this part here, which might override some other variables. So that's no good. But what is the problem if I want to generate code for this expression here, X is equal to Y is equal to 7? An additional problem. So what is the value? Yeah.
What that happens is the 7 is only stored in the register where the Y is, not there where we would expect it or finally going also to the X.
So yes. The result. Yeah. So the point is our assumption with the code generation, with the code RI function, is that the result lies in I. And we need this so that if we generate code for X equals Y equals 7, then if we evaluate this in register I, the result needs to be in register I. And if we just use this abbreviated code generation function, 7 would be stored into the register where Y is stored. But RI, the current register, will not hold 7 because we're not even mentioning I in here, because we just store directly in register RA. Okay, so RI will be undefined, and then we'll store this undefined variable in X. Is that clear? Okay, as an example. So suppose we had the task of generating code I. So if we use this code generation scheme and we say X is equal to Y is equal to 7, then we would say, well, generate the code for code R in I for Y equals 7 row, and then generate a move. Already wrong. So this is not I. So suppose row of Y is B and row of X is A. Then we would say, generate the code for Y is equal to 7 and store it in register A, because that's the register of X. And then code A R of Y equals 7 under row will generate, well, the right-hand side here, which is load constant. Oops, it's not a subscript. Load constant 7. In which register? In register of Y, which is B. So R, B, 7. We store 7 in the register of Y, which will correctly set Y to 7. So no problem there. And so this is the code that's been substituted up here. So all we have is load the constant 7 into RB, and we call our code generation function with A, but A is not even used in here, so X is never assigned to anything. X is left untouched. So we cannot have this simpler code generation scheme because it validates, like, it violates our assumption that the result is an I, which is crucial for generating correct code. Okay. Is this clear? Yeah. Okay. So we had this example with the constants. Now we have again this observation that we had earlier, that the temporary registers are actually reused. So if we have 3 times 4 plus 3 times 4, we first compute 3 times 4 and then again 3 times 4. And by following the code generation schema, this is E1 and this is E2. So we first generate code for E1, which is 3 times 4 in register 4, and then we generate code for 3 times 4 in the register 5, and then we add the results and store it in R4 because that is the destination register. Now, in general, code for 3 times 4 is produced parametrically using the generation scheme, so I'm just writing it down here for any target register. So first we load the constant 3 into RI, the constant 4 into RI plus 1. We multiply them, and then we store the result in RI. So if we substitute this expression in here, we get load C. What do I get? Maybe we should go. So like we start with index 4, and this is RI, so this is 4. We get R4, 3. Next one is? Okay. Yeah, anybody else wants to say that? You want to say that? So what's the code for this part? If you just put it in here. Okay. Well. So now it's R5 because here we pass 5 for the I. So it's R5, 3, and then? R5, R6. Okay, now we have the result of the sub-expressions in R4 and R5, and then the final instruction is this, which is add R4, R5. So now we have the result in R4, and we've used two more temporary registers, namely R5 and R6. Okay, so this is the result. Okay, and now you can see that like the more complex the expression is, the more registers we use temporarily, and so it's always necessary that all the registers greater equal to I are actually not used anywhere. Okay, so these are the different registers that the RCMA knows about. So we have addition. So we have like this is the semantics of them, and this kind of already maps to the abstract syntax tree nodes. So if we have addition, we have subtraction, we have division, we have multiplication, we have modulus. So I've actually looked up what the meaning should be. So the result. You compute the modulus of R, so you do a division of Rj divided by Rk, and you check what the remainder is if you multiply the division result by n. By some sort of n, then the remainder k is positive and between 0 and strictly less than the absolute value of Rk. And then you multiply this value by the sine of Rk. This is the proper semantics in C. Then for comparison operations, C has So these operations model the C semantics. So if we compare two values, you get one if the result is true, and you get zero otherwise. And it's an integer. And you can, so you could just say A is less than B plus C is less than D, and you get a value between 0 and 2. I think in the old standard it said something like 0 and non-zero, but I don't think that's true anymore. I think it's now 0 and 1. You have an equality operation, less equal, greater equal, and an AND, which is bitwise, so that corresponds to this C operator, which I'm using here as well, which is very different to the logical AND, which is this, which just checks whether the first argument is greater or equal to, not non-zero, and then checks that the second argument is non-zero, and if both are non-zero, it returns non-zero, or one, actually. So then we have OR, bitwise OR. In the schema, all the memory cells contain an integer, and I'm not saying whether it's 32-bit, so we just assume there's no overflow, no wrapping. Or if we assume the wrapping is exactly as it is in C, so we don't worry about that. We're a bit sloppy. So unary operators, there's just two, which is negation and not. The code generation scheme for such an operator is that, using prefix notation, we could have in C it would be negation is minus and not is the question, the exclamation. Mark operator. So we first generate the value of E in the register I, and then we apply the operation on that same register, storing the result in the same register. Which is actually quite similar to the bin binary operations, because we also use the same target register as the second argument. The first argument. So if we have minus 4, we translate this, assuming that's in the syntax tree, we have minus and it has an operation, operand 4. We translate this by translating the 4 and then negating the register. Yeah, so that's the code there. And there's also semantics. So not the exclamation mark checks whether the register is 0 and returns 1, otherwise 0. And this just returns the negative value. Okay, so now I'm going to discuss variables. So I said earlier, we can have these local variables and they will live in the Java Virtual Machine. They somewhere live down in the stack. And it's very similar now if you think of this register sequence as being allocated inside, as if it were a stack, then the values of these local variables will live at addresses that are always smaller than the current I, the current top of the register that we can use for computing temporary values. So assuming that we have a function with three variables x, y, z, we could then go through the syntax tree and give them memory cells, so assign them to memory cells. So, for instance, we could use the following mapping. We could say, x lives at memory cell, or in register, this case, 1, y lives at register 2, and z lives in register 3. And then, if that's all the registers we need for variables, then we can just start code in the register 4. So, we're using register 4 and above for temporary computations. So assuming that we use 4, we should... there's no R, but that's okay. We'll later see why the R is missing. So if we have this assignment... Let's make an R in there. We first compute the right-hand side and then do a move, as we've seen earlier. But this time, we use this address environment and we look up where x is stored, and it is stored at 1, so we move the result to 1. We saw that earlier, but we do this anyway now, so let's assume we need to first evaluate this expression in register 4. So what we do is we generate the code for the left-hand side, which so and then the right-hand side. So the left-hand side is simply code R4 of Y, and that is defined to be a move, well, what it says. It's a move, and we're moving the current the value of Y, which is stored in register 2, to the register where we want to have the result, which is 4. So this 4 here. And then in register 5, we compute the expression Z plus Z times 3. So what is what does that code do? How does that code look like? Sorry, in 5. Z times 3 in a row. What does this code look like? Somebody else. First, I need to generate code for Z. Yeah, I need to. Yeah, well, let's follow the scheme, so it will be R5. Oh dear. So I generated in R5, and where does Z live? In R3. So I move the contents from R3, because that's where Z lives, into R5, and then I generate code for 3, which is load C. Yes. 3, yeah. So remember the code generation scheme, first expression in register I, second expression in register I plus 1, so that's why the constant 6 winds up in register 6. Oh, the constant 3 winds up in register 6, I plus 1, I plus 1. And then we do the multiplication, yeah, with R5, R6. Target register, which is determined here, and the two values we've computed for the expression, the two registers that contain the values of the expressions. There it is. Oh yeah, well, so there. So this is also a good example that this whole code generation is kind of structural induction. So you can first descend into your syntax tree and then bottom up gather up the code. First generate code for the 3 and you plug it into the sequence of code for Z times 3, and you pass that up, and then you embed that into this code sequence, and then you embed that in this code sequence. And at the top, say at the function, eventually you will have all the code for the function. So at the moment, we only have dealt with expressions. Okay, so then later on, if we just write it to a file, you just see this instruction sequence, and you then have to look for, like, you have to look, eyeball the code to actually understand what it's doing, but this is the way the compiler generates the code. Okay. Well, let's do some more. So I guess I'm a bit fast, but I think that's okay. So about statements and expressions. So far, we've only done expressions. Let's do some statements. Actually, this might be also part of the plan. Yeah, I think it's control structures that I don't want to do today. So we've only generated code for expressions, and we always had this magical R here. And this R actually stands for R value, and I'll explain that in a bit. We now also use a code generation which is just called code, which is for instructions. And here we have statements, I should say. So the code function without any subscript just stands for code generation for a statement. It also takes an address environment because it has to know about where variables live. And it also takes the register where the value of that statement should be. Well, no, that's wrong. It needs the argument I to know where how code is generated for expressions, but the value of a statement is nothing. It's pointless to use because a statement doesn't have a value. But it needs the I argument to know which registers are available for temporary computations. So I and I plus one, they're always unused registers. So we've already seen that if we have an expression x equals e, where x lives at in register r a, then we can generate code for this expression by generating the code of e and then moving this result, which is in r register ri, to r a. However, this x equals a is also a statement like while and if. And if we generate code for the statement x equals to e, we simply do the following. We just call the code generation for the expression e1 equals to e2. So this might seem like a bogus thing to actually mention, but it is quite helpful to understand that in the C grammar, you have statements, and the statement production goes to an expression. And inside the expression, you have an assignment. So assignment is just a side effect of evaluating an expression. And this is reflected because, so let's say S is a statement. So S goes to if something, and it goes to while in C something, and it goes to E. And then E goes to E plus E, and so on. And yeah. But normally you'd have a statement, well, if I construct the grammar, you'd have the statement sequence, which is S semicolon SS or S. So the semicolon comes in somewhere else. If you have an if without a statement sequence. Well, you can say something like, okay, you're probably right, I don't know. So you can say, this, which means an empty basic block, empty then branch. True, but like you'd always have a semicolon. Okay,
I mean, because you always have a semicolon, even if you don't have a statement sequence.
Okay, I would have to think about what is possible, what not, and what the grammar looks like. It's probably best to look up the grammar. You might be right. Okay, however, there will be some transition from a statement to an expression, and this is exactly the difference, because code defines the code generation function for statements, no matter where the semicolon is, and code R defines the code generation function for expressions. And so since there is one transition where you have a statement that goes to an expression, you will have to have some functionality for this production, and this is exactly this one. It's exactly the one that takes some sort of statement and pretends that it's an expression and evaluates it as an expression. Okay, and the result in register I is ignored when you generate code for a statement. The I is just there so that you are able to call the code generation function for the expression because that expects the I. Okay. So as I said, the assignment to E1 in this assignment is a side effect of evaluating an expression. So, So if we have a sequence of statements which is defined in the grammar of C somewhere, with or without semicolon, then the statements that we're generating as code for this statement sequence is just the concatenation of the individual instructions. So we define the code generation for statements. If we have S followed by more statements, we generate the code for S, and then we generate code for the remaining statements. And if this remaining sequence is empty, we don't generate any code. So here S is for single statement, S is a sequence of statements. Okay. So control flow. Statements like if and while will have some sort of a control flow, like jumps in them. Basically, if you have an if statement, you need to jump over the then branch to the else branch if the condition is false. And vice versa, if the condition is true, you will first execute the then branch, but then you might, if there is an else branch, you need to jump over the else branch. And for that, we need so-called control flow instructions that change the control flow. And one of them is jump A, where A is a constant, and the semantics is that the program counter is set to A. So if you remember this infinite loop that reads the instruction, increments the program pointer, executes the instruction, then here the executing the instruction will just set the program counter to a new address, and then the loop will resume and read the instruction from that address. So the control flow has moved on to some other address. Now there's also conditional jumps. So if we have an if statement, then you want to occasionally jump there, but sometimes not, and that depends on some value. So the conditional, for this we have a conditional jump that branch depending on the value in some register. So the mnemonic is jump 0, and it jumps if the register I contains a 0. So if the register I does contain something that is not 0, which is I've indicated here with not, well, with exclamation mark 0. So as an example 2, then the state of the machine will be unchanged, and we'll still have 2 in here. However, if the register contains 0, it will contain 0 afterwards, but the program counter will have changed to be A now. And this is the semantics in C. I think this is relatively easy. And unless I've done it wrong, then it's obviously complicated, but I think it's okay. So, control flow. Yeah, so let's, as I said, we need to have some sort of jump instructions. So if we translate an if statement, the problem is we need to generate code that says jump 0 register address, and we don't know that address yet. So this is a general problem of generating code, that we need to be able to jump to addresses, to pieces of code that we haven't emitted yet. And this is usually done by the assembler, so this is like delegated to some other program. So what we're going to do is to find some sort of like abstract representation of the code we're generating. We don't want to like only generate a straight sequence of instructions, but we want to be able to somehow induce the control flow without actually putting everything at fixed addresses or at addresses that we have to resolve later. So what we want to do is we want to have some abstract view of the control flow, and that is useful because then later on we might do some optimizations that allows us to arrange the instruction sequence in different orders. So, for instance, we could try to minimize the number of unconditional jumps. So if we have an unconditional jump that jumps to some basic block and there's no other unconditional jump that goes to that block, we can move this basic block where we're jumping to and merge it with the basic block that has the jump in it, and then we save executing the jump. So if we have a basic block with a jump in here, and it jumps into the other basic block, so let's say this is A, this is B, and there's no other incoming node, like from an unconditional jump to B, we could just emit the code A and then B and omit the jump instruction, which will be faster because we're saving on the jump. This is particularly interesting if we have jumps inside loops, because we have to assume that loops are executed much more frequently than anything that lies outside the loop. Otherwise, this is usually true because the only time that a loop, that assumption is not true, is when the loop only executes once. If it executes zero times, it doesn't actually matter what's inside the loop. So normally a loop can be assumed to execute more than one time, and so it's very important that inside the loop we have very efficient code and few jumps in particular. And some architectures distinguish between far jumps that allow a longer and a bigger address and near jumps that allow shorter addresses. So rearranging the blocks of code that we have in our program can mean that we can change a far jump into a near jump, which saves space. So the general idea is to organize the instruction sequences that we emit into blocks that don't contain jumps. And these blocks of code, they're called basic blocks. So a basic block is a sequence of statements, I use the SS again, that do not contain a jump. And then we can think of the program as a graph of basic blocks, and they're connected by edges that represent jump instructions. So if it is a conditional jump, we can have more than one outgoing edge, because we have one outgoing edge for the case where the condition is true and one outgoing edge for the case where the condition is false. And then we will just write the condition onto the edge. For an unconditional jump, we just have one outgoing edge, and there's no condition attached to this edge. Whereas for incoming edges, we can have any number of incoming edges to a basic block. Okay, so the abstract way, in an abstract way, we could like look at a program to have be a graph where the nodes look like this. So we can have an arbitrary number of incoming nodes. We have some sort of code without any jumps, and then we can have an outgoing edge, and there's a condition on the edge. And usually, if there's two edges, then we have a positive condition on this edge and a negative condition on that edge. So either we have a single outgoing edge, which would be an unconditional jump, or we have two edges, and one of the conditions is that some sort of C register, whatever, has to be zero. So it should be a register, really. And the other edge, well, in our special case, because we only have this jump zero instruction, we just have to assume that... So if this is RC, the register C, then here we test C, RC for being zero, and on this branch, the RC is non-zero. Then we can translate it directly with a jump zero that jumps over here. And this is just an unconditional jump. Or actually, if we can manage, we can just squeeze the next block, the next basic block, just behind this basic block. Okay. And later on, we will have a set of edges that contains more than two edges, and then that is used for switch statements. Then we have a set of edges where each edge has a condition and one edge that is the default edge. So if you remember if you recall the C switch statement, you have a few cases, and you can have one default statement which doesn't have a condition, and so that's reflected here when we generate code where we then have a basic block with several. Edges where we have various conditions, and we have one edge that has no condition, which is the default case. And we'll have different instructions for that, but that's later. Okay. So normally, if we would generate code directly for control flow instructions, we would have to generate code that jump to instructions we haven't even written out, and so we don't know the address in the code segment where these instructions that we haven't emitted yet will live. So for instance, if you emit the code for an if statement, you will first have the condition, and then you have the jump, and in this jump you have some address A, and late, and the address A is the else branch, but we haven't emitted the code for the else branch. We don't know where it lives either, because in here will be the code for the then branch that we don't know yet, because we haven't generated it yet. So there's a bit of a technical problem. So normally what we do is we have to so-called resolve these addresses. So first what we do is we just say, oh, we have labels, and then we just say, oh, jump to A, and A is a label, and then later on we have a second pass where we know actually where each basic block lives, so we know what the value of A is, and then we insert the value into the instruction itself. So this is called resolving the symbolic addresses, so A is a symbolic address, to actual addresses. This is usually done by the assembler, and we're not going to deal with that, because it's just technicality, really. An alternative is, so in case I'm confusing, so normally you have the compiler emitting assembler with symbolic jump targets, and then you have the assembler that does the that resolves these symbolic jumps with actual addresses, and then you have an executable that only has fixed addresses. An alternative is sometimes your machine or your architecture has relative jumps. So relative jump is an instruction that doesn't take an absolute address in the code segment, but a difference to the current PC. So something like jump minus 52, which has the semantics that it will just subtract 52 from the current program counter. And in this case, you still have to do the resolution, but the nice thing is that what you generate is code that doesn't care about the actual position within the code segment, and this is called position-independent code. And this is useful for libraries, because if you then call a library function, you can put the library function anywhere in your address space, and you can jump to it, and it doesn't know where the address of the individual instructions are, because it always jumps relative. So position independent code can be loaded at any actual address and then executed there, which has certain advantages. An alternative is what has been used in, well, what which is still being used, is that when you have to load code at a different address to where these absolute addresses were compiled to, you have to change all the locations where absolute addresses are mentioned by adding a difference. And that's done at when you load an executable. Okay. So we're not really concerned about all of this, because what we'll do is we just like emit assembler with symbolic labels, and assume that there's an assembler that resolves these labels later. So what we will emit are symbolic labels, and inside the compiler we will actually not even have a linear structure, we just have a graph with these outgoing edges, with these jump edges, and this is much easier to use for program optimizations, as I mentioned, that you want to merge basic blocks. Okay, so let's do the if statement. How do we generate code for an if statement? So assume that the statement is if condition, then do the statement sequence. And we will first I will show only the code generation schemes without basic blocks, because basic blocks will create if we want to do one with basic blocks, we'd kind of have to emit a graph, and that's a bit difficult to write down. So we'll just create a linear sequence with symbolic addresses, and if you want to implement it, you might just implement it as a graph, really. Okay, so what do we do if we emit an if statement? So we first emit the code for the condition, and then afterwards we emit the code for the statement sequence. And then we insert a jump between the code and the statement sequence, so that in case the condition is false, we jump over this sequence of statements. So, and I can represent it like this. So the code for the statement S, if it's an if statement, note there's no R, so because we're talking about a statement. We generate the code for the condition, which uses the code generation function for expressions, because C is an expression. The result will be in RI, and then we issue the jump. If RI contains zero, then we jump to A. So if the condition is false, we jump over the set of instructions SS, so over this code. Then we emit the code, and then we emit a label, and we just assume by magic later the assembler will resolve the address A to whatever this point in the program will be. Okay. So for the if statement, in general, if it has an else branch as well as a then branch, we can create a little graph like this. So first we generate a basic block with the code for the condition. Then we have a jump, which has so there should be a condition here. So if the C turns out to be false, then so this should be not C and this is C. If the condition turns out to be false, we jump to the else branch, to the basic block that implements the else statements. And if the condition is true, we jump to the then branch. And both of these statements jump to whatever basic block we're generating after the if statement. So this would be something you could implement to get a graph representation, but it's very difficult to write down. So what I'll do is I'll write down the code generation scheme using labels. So if I want to translate if condition true, then branch, else branch statements, I'll generate the code for C and emit an instruction that jumps if the condition is zero. So if it's false, I jump over the code for the then branch and I jump to A, which is the code for the else branch. Now after this jump, I emit the code for the then branch. And at the end of the then branch, I need to jump over the else branch. So I have an unconditional jump that jumps over the else branch to a label that lies beyond the if statement. And so you can look at this diagram here, which is basically saying the same thing. I jump over the code for the then branch if the condition is false. And at the end of the then branch, I need to jump over the else branch to the code after the if statement. Okay, so as an example, if we generate code for this if statement here, we will have let's do the skeleton. So what is the first what am I going to emit first? So this condition is GR, greater. So I'll first generate the code for the condition. So I will, let's be a little bit abstract, so I will just say code R of I of X, code I plus 1 R for Y. So I'm generating code in register RI for X, in register RI plus 1 for Y, and then I will generate the binary operator with our usual scheme, so that the end result is in RI. So now RI is non-zero if this is true. So I say jump 0 RI to the else branch. I'll call that A. A is here. Then here I have code no subscript because it's a statement of X equals X minus Y. And here in the else branch, I have the code y is equal to y minus x. Okay, so what's missing? The jump. So what do I put in? Jump. The B label here. Okay. All right, so I'll finish with this example. Are there any more questions? Okay, so next week I think we'll just do this example in more detail just to practice what we've done today, and then we'll continue with while and other constructs. Thank you.